Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Excellent. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to LSE, to everybody in the room, to those of you joining us online for this afternoon's event, which is part of the LSE Festival, How to Save the Planet. My name's Emily Jackson. I'm a professor in the law school here at LSE. And I'm incredibly honoured to introduce our exceptionally distinguished panel. So on my far right is John Byrne Murdoch. He's a columnist and the chief data reporter for the Financial Times, for which he writes the weekly Data Points column. He's also a visiting senior fellow at the Data Science Institute at LSE. And I know many of us benefited hugely from his translation of scientific data into digestible charts during the pandemic. But his work for the FT goes much, much further than that. And his wonderful AI Shift newsletter, exploring how AI is transforming work, recently won Best Newsletter in the World. Next to him is Helen Pearson, who's been writing for and editing Nature, the world's leading science journal, for more than 20 years. Winning Editor of the Year Award for the Association of British Science Writers, and last year winning the European Science Journalist of the Year. Her first book, The Life Project, was Science Book of the Year for The Observer and was longlisted for the Orwell Prize. Helen's second book, Beyond Belief, How Evidence Shows What Really Works, has just been published and is a story of the movement to promote evidence-based thinking and policymaking. Nearest to me, David Shookman worked at the BBC for decades, reporting on crucial moments in history, including the fall of the Berlin Wall. He was the BBC's first science editor and was praised by Sir David Attenborough as a leader in raising awareness about the climate emergency. David is also currently a visiting professor in practice at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment here at LSE, and last year received an honorary doctorate from Durham University in recognition of his exceptional ability to convey scientific evidence and complex research in an accessible way. The task he's continued in his latest book, The Response, A Story of Fire and Flood in Britain's New World of Extremes, which has recently been published. So what we're going to do today is talk about how scientific evidence can help us in an age of alternative facts. For social media users, the hashtag is hashtag LSE Festival, but please do put your phones on silent. The event is going to be recorded, and as long as we don't have any technical hitches, will be made available as a podcast and video. There's going to be a chance for you to put questions to the panel towards the end, and for people online, please submit questions via the Q&A feature on whatever platform you're on. After the event, copies of Helen and David's fantastic books are available for sale outside, and they're going to stay around to sign them for you. So how we're going to run this is Helen, David and John are each going to make some opening remarks. We're then going to have a bit of a conversation, and after that we'll open up to questions for the floor. So if we could just begin, perhaps with you.
Lovely. Yeah, thank you for the introduction, and thanks to everyone for being here. So I want to start with a little example that I think demonstrates quite neatly why evidence is still really important and often overlooked. So this is actually from across the Atlantic, our friends, or I'm not sure they're friends anymore, in America. In the US education system, they, a bit like our SATs, they test everyone actually about age 10 on their ability in reading maths and science. California is pretty much the richest state in the US. Mississippi is pretty much the poorest state in the US. Now, in 2013, California was getting close to the best results in the country for reading at age 10. Mississippi was getting 49th out of 51, pretty much the worst results in the country for reading. 2024, 11 years later, Mississippi has overtaken California, despite the fact that California spends 50% more per pupil on its education. And what happened there is that a few decades ago in America, schools started teaching language using a system called the whole language method, which basically asks kids to try and figure out what a word is based on the context in which it appears. Whereas even back then, evidence showed that the phonics system, where you teach people how to make individual sounds, was more effective at reading. Now, most states, including California, just went with the whole language approach. It sort of felt nicer, the teachers enjoyed it more. Mississippi, starting in 2013, switched to the phonics approach. They switched their teaching to that approach. They also switched their training of teachers to make sure the staff were specialists in that approach. And they introduced something where if students by age 9 weren't able to read at least a decent level, they would be held back until they could. So 11 years later, this dramatic improvement in Mississippi's performance. And people sometimes look at these things and they say, well, that sounds just pretty strict. And even if it works, presumably that's the kind of thing that works for well-off people with like pushy parents, but what about the people at the bottom? It actually works especially well for people at the bottom. So if I just check the numbers, by last year in California, only 28% of black kids in California can read at a basic level, compared to 52% in Mississippi. So this was evidence that has been known about for a very, very long time, but was only instituted just over a decade ago. It's worked incredibly well and massively closed that funding gap.
Thank you.
A great story.
Okay, I've got two stories, so bear with me, both from my book. So I've spent the last 5 years or so speaking to about 200 people about evidence and the importance of evidence across different fields, including education, actually. It's quite a great example. So I'm going to tell you two stories that illustrate why evidence matters. So the first is an example of what happens when we don't use evidence and we rely on sort of unsubstantiated opinion. And this goes back to a particular book called Baby and Childcare, which was written by the paediatrician Benjamin Spock, and it was first published in the 1950s. Now, in early editions of this book, Dr. Spock recommended that babies be laid down to sleep on their backs. And the 1958 version, which I have a copy of because my mum sent it to me, he made a small change. It's a really small change to the text, which recommended that babies be put to sleep on their fronts. He didn't have particularly strong reasons for advocating that. He thought maybe, you know, babies that slept on their backs got flat heads or maybe choked on their own vomit. But because this book was an absolutely huge bestseller in the parenting world, and other paediatricians said the same thing, there was a rise in the number of parents who followed this advice. Okay, so meanwhile, in the literature, there's unfortunately a kind of sinister rise of children who are dying from sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And a lot of debate, why was this happening? It was really unclear. Now, what was missing from all of this was evidence from careful studies. What was needed were case control studies, which looked at a group of children who died from SIDS and compared it to a similar group who hadn't, to try and tease out what were the factors responsible. Now, the first of those studies came out about 1965, the second about 1970. It was still quite hard to see the link. But over time, the weight of evidence built up until it became very clear that actually putting children to sleep on their fronts was linked to an increased risk of SIDS. You know, this advice from Dr. Spock and others was eventually called one of the most lethal pieces of unsubstantiated advice in the history of child health. What makes it all the more tragic is that scientists went back and calculated that if evidence had been synthesized, these studies had been put together and acted on earlier, about 10,000 babies' lives could have been saved in the UK alone, and 50,000 in the US and Australasia. So it's really a kind of powerful example of the importance of doing studies, of trying to find causes, and of also pulling together the evidence as a whole. Will you allow me one more story?
Yes, absolutely.
Seems we've got an hour. So the other story that sort of came out of the book is one of the reasons I wrote it, is sort of illustrates how evidence is this really recent phenomenon. So the reason I wrote the book was because a few years ago I met a very inspirational character called Ian Chalmers. He is a doctor, he's a researcher, and in the 1960s he was training to be a doctor and eventually working in obstetrics and gynaecology in the UK. And he noticed something odd about medicine, which was when two doctors gave advice for the same predicament to women, they would often give different advice. So some doctors thought bed rest was really important, some doctors would prescribe a cesarean section in this particular situation, and others would prescribe no such thing. And what actually generally happened was that everyone followed the advice of the most senior doctor in the room, which is today sometimes known as eminence-based medicine, or an acronym I particularly like, which is GOBSAT, which is G-O-B-S-A-T, which means good old boys sat around the table pontificating about what they ought to do. So, you know, Ian's kind of puzzled by this. He felt like there should be a better way to work out, like, which treatment is most effective here. He came across a very seminal book published in 1972 by a doctor called Archie Cochrane, who advocated that actually the best way to work out whether one treatment is more effective than another is to use empirical evidence, by which we mean evidence from observation and careful experimentation. And he also advocated the most sort of trustworthy form of evidence was from randomised trials, when people are randomised to a treatment and control group and we see whether the treatment group improved faster. So this inspired Ian to do a really kind of pioneering thing, which was he went off to try and gather together all of the controlled clinical trials which had been done testing treatments in pregnancy and childbirth. He synthesized them all together into hundreds of systematic reviews and produced these two pioneering books, which actually showed that a lot of the treatments which were being given to women were either not supported by evidence or were harmful, including things like shaving women's pubic hair during labor, or even doing invasive episiotomies with the idea that they give babies a bigger opening to get out. So countless women had been subjected to these invasive and highly degrading practices just because doctors assumed they were the right thing to do. And Ian's work helped bring an end to them, and this is kind of one really important part. There's a whole other strand of the story going on in the US, but bringing medicine from eminence-based medicine to evidence-based medicine. And just one thing, and then I'll stop talking. Evidence-based medicine as a term was only introduced in 1991 in the medical literature, very, very recently. And then from that point, kind of rocketed around the world. Thank you.
Come on,
that's great. Two fast stories.
The bar's pretty high, isn't it, for this storytelling? I want to introduce you to a couple in their 70s, living in a terraced house on the eastern edge of London, Lynn and Terry. And Terry has COPD, the lung condition, which is made worse by higher temperatures. And the day in question is the 19th of July, 2022. So coming up on 4 years ago, and the Met Office had forecast that the temperature that day would be a record for Britain of 40 degrees, a big jump from the previous record. Bad things happen at 40 degrees in a society that's not ready for it. Lynn, knowing that Terry would be in trouble at 40 degrees, had made all kinds of arrangements to look after him. Had a fan at his feet, a little aircon unit. He was stripped down to his underpants and just in an armchair watching television. When, at about lunchtime, there was a loud hammering on the door, and their neighbours said, "There's a wildfire in our village on the edge of London." Wildfire in London? And no one kind of believed this was possible. Wildfires, you have them in California or Australia or Portugal. London? Can't be right. Anyway, the police banged in the door and said, "You are leaving now." And Lynn and Terry stumbled out into the street, 40 degrees temperature, the sky was dark with smoke, all the neighbours panicking. Luckily, Lynn had managed to persuade the policeman to give her just a few seconds to grab Terry some clothes so he wasn't in the street in his underpants. But she wasn't given the time to get her purse, her pet cat, some important documents. So there they were, basically with nothing. And the whole community was living through an experience that was completely beyond anything they had ever imagined possible. Wildfire in London. They were all taken round to a sort of refuge, a restaurant a couple of miles away. And while they were there, and Terry was being treated by paramedics, he hadn't had time to bring his medication, they learnt that among the 18 houses burnt in their village, theirs was one of them. Lynn collapsed. What an appalling shock. I mean, how could you go from just sitting in this appalling heat to actually losing your house in this unimaginable wildfire? That day, 40 houses were burnt to the ground in the London area because of wildfires. Another 30 in other parts of England, total of 70, the largest loss by miles of British housing to wildfire ever. And no one was ready. The London Fire Brigade admits that on the day it wasn't ready, and it encountered a wave of problems. If you're in one of those classic firefighting flame suits, which have a padded lining, which helps you if you're going to run into a burning house for 10 minutes, tackle a fire, run out again, absolutely unsuitable if you're out in the open in 40 degrees for 8, 10 hours, firefighters were dropping like flies. They also found that when the first crew to get to Lynn's village connected their hoses to the water mains, standard practice, and they reported to the control that the pressure was really weak. The water pressure in the mains was too weak for firefighting. And this was a curse all day. For the 6 hours of the worst of the fires in that village, they were short of water. Water in this country is in the hands of privatized utilities. When the privatizations happened, it turns out, the water companies were given a metric for how much water to provide to households, 9 litres a minute, but they weren't given a metric for supporting firefighting. There's a sort of rather nebulous arrangement that obviously on that day didn't work. I became a bit obsessed to the point that my wife was worried about me going down rabbit holes with freedom of information requests to try to find out how many houses burnt. I mean, did Lynn's house burn because of the shortage of water, because the privatized utility had its hand on the tap and wasn't being helpful enough? So you think, well, maybe that was one village, okay, a few dozen houses burnt that day. Is this really a big deal? The Ordnance Survey, which is the preeminent mapping institution in this country and has been for more than a century, did a study of how many homes in England are within 100 metres of open land. Because if it's, we all want to live near open land, parks and playing fields, it's a sort of an attraction for a home. Except when you get 40 degrees and prolonged dry conditions, when everything changes, and these places can become a menace. So the Ordnance Survey looked at how many homes were there within kind of ember-blowing distance, let's say, of open land, of the kind that might catch fire. And they came up with a total of 1.8 million. Now, John, I'm sure, would think, well, let's say they've got their numbers wrong. And the old journalistic thing I was taught when I was starting in journalism, if you're confronted with an amazingly large number, which you kind of have a big question mark over, can it really be that bad? Lop a naught off the end. Is it still a story? So is it still a story that the Ordnance Survey reckons 180,000 homes in England are at risk of wildfire? Well, the answer's yes. So my take on this evidence question is it's about joining up actually quite random points of evidence, because just in that one story, there's the evidence that the firefighters bring to the discussion. There's the evidence of climate scientists. There's the evidence of digital mapping. And there's the evidence of the lived experience that people actually endure and have to go through and cope with. No one died that day, July the 19th, 2022, of wildfires, although Terry found the experience so stressful and his COPD got worse and worse and worse, and he was rushed to hospital more and more often. They were living in temporary accommodation because their house had totally burnt down, that he died within a year of the fires. Officially, no death is linked to the wildfires. Talk to Lynn about it, and the fire killed Terry. Sorry, stunned silence there.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know whether any of you have follow-up questions for each other or whether I should just launch in with a question for you all, which is, I guess, a really basic question of what is evidence. I don't know whether you'd like to go first, John.
Yeah, I come across this a lot, and Helen, you and I were talking about this back there. In my job, I'm often coming to a topic relatively fresh because I flit around from thing to thing. And so I will dive into the academic literature to make sure, right, what should I know about this field before I get my hands dirty in it? And quite often, I'll get lots of nice, neat, published scientific evidence. And it all contradicts. They all contradict each other. There's often different schools of thought. So, you know, there's evidence is evidence. People are always trying their best. But I think it's really important to appreciate that things are rarely as clear-cut as some of the examples we talk about. You know, like randomised control trials are fantastic, and there are obviously certain fields in the hard science, in the hard sciences, where there is a very clear line between what the evidence says and what it doesn't. But as we get into social sciences and various other areas, that line does get fuzzier. So I guess I'm not really saying what is evidence, but how should we think about evidence in some of these less settled fields? And this is, if I come across one of these examples, I'm then often going out and speaking to people and trying to get someone's sense of how I should be weighing those different bits of evidence. But yeah, it's often not as nice a black and white issue as we might think.
Yeah, so I looked at this for the book. I mean, the dictionary definition of evidence is information that indicates whether a belief or proposition is true or valid. So it's information. And I think that, I mean, I think this is a key point, is that there's a lot of confusion and people are using the word evidence in very different ways. So even in science, it's kind of used in different ways. And I think scientists assume that when we talk about evidence, it's evidence from science. But there's evidence in a court of law, which is just information presented in the court of law. There's, you know, evidence from lived experience, which some scientists might think is absolutely valid scientific evidence and some wouldn't. So, and I think that's a key debate. And the reason that becomes important, I think, is when people take the term evidence and they latch it onto something, you know, evidence-based X, and they sort of use it to give a gloss of legitimacy, let's say, to something which isn't deserved. I mean, I looked the other day because I was writing a talk for evidence-based on Amazon and came up with evidence-based horsemanship and evidence-based golf. Now, I'm not, they could be very, very good science-based books, and I can't comment on them, but I'm just saying this term has sort of gone out into the world and been attached to lots of things. And of course, now it's being abused as well. I mean, the Trump administration uses it as well, to, you know, like gold standard science and evidence-based this, when they're actually kind of, you know, using that in a way to kind of cast a doubt on some solid evidence. So it's a deceptively complicated term.
That's right. I think you can think of it and define it in many different ways. And I think my way through this is to try and think, well, what most convinces me about something? And I think in terms of climate, I've always made a distinction between measured facts, you know, what is the temperature record in the instrumental record going back 100 or so years? What is the record from proxies, tree rings, etc., lake sediments, and they're different qualitatively, but I think they're both measurable. And the distinction would be with models projecting forwards. You know, they can't give you the same calibre of evidence as what thermometers have told us over the last century. You can have quite narrow bands of uncertainty looking ahead, particularly 20, 30, 40 years, and obviously it's the wider bands when you get towards the end of the century or beyond. And I think I've heard climate scientists or people speaking about climate science sometimes sort of say the evidence of the models tells us. And that alarms me, because I think it's different. In the public mind, evidence probably does mean something you can really get your mitts on, like a thermometer record, for example. And I think we have to be very, very careful. And a broader point linked to that is, I mentioned uncertainty. Uncertainty in a scientific context means something actually quite precise. But to the public, it means you don't know. And I think evidence is possibly edging into that category a little bit in the public mind, made worse by the likes of Trump. You know, one of his Truth Social posts the other day, when he was really attacking the most extreme climate model, RCP 8.5, and there's a whole thing we could debate about that. But nevertheless, he said, my administration is based on facts and evidence and truth. And you think, well, actually it isn't. But nevertheless, you know, so I think we've got to be very, very careful in using these words about what we're actually talking about.
Can I just piggyback on something you said there as well? So on the predictions and models point, it's something we often think about at the FT. So in our team, the broader sort of data journalism team at the FT, there's increasingly this conversation about, should we be in the business of doing modelling and predictions? So especially that comes up with elections. Mm. So various US newsrooms have been doing forecasts of the US elections, going back over a decade now. But we've always felt, well, we feel as journalists, our job is to tell you what is happening, not start pointing at what might happen. Now, that is a judgment call. I don't know if we're wrong or right, and the Americans are the other side of it. But it is something, as you say, that we do think about carefully, because if you start saying something might happen, then it doesn't happen. Mm. Even though it shouldn't, that often does lead people to change their opinions of how seriously they should take you. Whereas if you are at least pointing to things that have happened or are happening, you're on more solid ground. So there's the trade-off not only in, as you say, how the public thinks about it, but in what that potentially does to trust in you if the models end up being off.
Can I just pick up on that? Because I describe in my book a moment in the newsroom when a storm surge was approaching the east coast of England in 2013, and the Environment Agency and all the authorities along that coast were warning this was maximum life to danger because it was going to coincide with a high tide. And in 1953, 300 people died along that coast when a massive storm surge crashed over the shore and broke the defences. So the authorities and someone in the Cabinet Office got in touch with me directly to say we're activating the COBRA meeting system, we're going on full alert, prime ministers across all this, and you know it would be incredibly helpful if you at the BBC could give this warning maximum treatment. So we had a debate in the newsroom, you know, should it be the lead story on the main news that evening? And a lot of people, I was then science editor, turned to me and said, well, editor, well, what should we do? And exactly your point, the storm surge hadn't arrived at that moment. I mean, it was a few hours away. So as a news provider, is it our job to provide warnings of things that may or may not be as bad as the authorities say they will be? If we go really, really big on it, obviously that'll spread the word and people will get out of harm's way, which will lessen the number of people who might be affected and properties lost and all the rest of it. And we hummed and hawed, and in the end I said, okay, we kind of, there's a bit of a public duty thing going on, so let's lead with it. And we did, and in the end it was bad but not catastrophic. Nobody died. 600 homes were flooded, but it wasn't apocalypse. And we got a bit of flack. And I describe in a book this business of how, I remember one editor saying, kind of, really, come on, David, what do you think's going to happen? And I said, look, I really don't know if tomorrow morning we'll wake up and it'll be 30 dead or a slightly damp Ford Escort. You know, we can't tell. And in the end, the balance was, okay, we probably should go with this thing.
Do you have any sense of whether going big on it may have led people to get out of harm's way?
Well, I think it possibly did. I think if we were making enough noise about it. So that puts us in the category of a public service provider, less of a news provider. I mean, I was being a bit purist about this, but I think it's a point that, because the evidence, to pick up on this theme, that there wasn't any evidence at that stage that this would be a killer. It could be. Yeah. But wasn't then. So.
Great. My next question was about whether or not evidence differs across different fields. When we talk about evidence, is it the same when we're talking about medicine or climate or other aspects of evidence? Does it differ?
I mean, I'll take that, because I looked across, I started in medicine, ended up looking at like policy, education, conservation, you know, even up to sort of parenting, policing, which have all, in some sense, to a greater or less extent, sort of followed the medicine model of saying, actually, some people said, yeah, we need to be evidence-based about our decisions. I mean, the evidence is the same, and the methodologies are the same. I mean, a randomised trial in policy is still follows the same procedures as a randomised trial in medicine. But I do think the approaches to evidence are different. So, for example, I think, I mean, let's take the ways that, for example, evidence is synthesised. So one really strong message or sort of lesson I took from looking at evidence across all these fields is how important it is to move beyond the single study. So much of the media and even scientists themselves are just following the next study, but one study risks being wrong or flawed. So there's this really important part of science, which I don't think gets discussed enough, which is synthesising evidence using techniques called systematic reviews. So I've now become this complete systematic review geek. Not that I can do them, but I'm a sort of fan of them. But anyway, the point is that the way those are approached in different fields, like in medicine, you get your kind of systematic review purist to it's like systematic review or die. But in another field where, for example, it's much more difficult to do solid randomised controlled trials like conservation or the environment, then there's a much more kind of, I feel like there's a more inclusive approach to evidence. Like it will be like, well, we haven't got randomised trials, so we're going to, bring in our sort of, you know, quasi-experimental methods, and we're going to try and synthesize qualitative and quantitative evidence together, which is a really big and interesting challenge, right? How do you get different forms of knowledge? So that's what I see, is methodology is the same, but sort of what's considered to be evidence, coming back to where we were, it differs and sometimes has to be more pragmatic in other fields.
Yeah, I think in climate, you know, I was just thinking of the kind of my approach to the climate crisis, which is sort of bottom-up, as it were. If you're looking at something like flooding, you can't do a randomised control trial. I mean, you could have two similar communities and leave one utterly unprotected, and then have the other one with sort of flood walls and all the kind of defences. But you can't do that, because you know the people in the undefended one might die. So there are you have to assume, I think, that the sort of status quo serves as your control, and then you experiment with other pilot studies. So the classic is what's called sustainable urban drainage, which is a horrible term for making cities spongier. Because we've created these vast urban areas with impermeable surfaces, and we're getting heavier rainfall now because the atmosphere is warming and can hold more moisture, that's basic physics from the 19th century, we're encountering this massive problem of runoff, which we saw the consequences in Valencia, 200 dead, people trapped in their cars, people trapped in basements, people trapped all over the place, 11 dead in basements in New York with a big flash flood. So we know the problem. So there are different ideas for how you implement sustainable urban drainage schemes. It would be lovely for every road surface and every car park to be dug up and refitted with absorbent surfaces, but that's not going to happen. So what you do is you have smaller schemes, many, many more smaller schemes. And the truth is they're quite hard to measure. I mean, you might see popping up in various streets in London these raised flower beds, rain gardens. They're just anything to, they usually take up a parking space or two, and they're just designed to catch some rain and hold it for a while before releasing it into the drains below. And I've actually tried, maybe we should team up after this, but I've tried to get really kind of metrics on this. You know, how many cubic meters of soil do you need in one of these rain gardens in order to trap so many litres of water? That there are some studies, it's not wholly, we're not flying blind on this. But we know it works in principle, but much harder to show in practice. I think that'd be one example in climate of where it's actually much harder than in medicine.
I mean, just briefly, I mean, that's just a sort of classic dilemma in policy, right? It's like you don't have the perfect evidence for a randomised controlled trial to know whether the raised flower beds are going to work. Mm. But the hope is that people evaluate it as best they can.
Yeah.
Once it's in, and sometimes that evaluation step, of course, doesn't happen, so we don't gather the knowledge that we hope to use in the future.
Because the classic, just picking that up, is, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to climate change is companies, governments, organisations say, well, we'll plant some trees. And often these tree planting schemes are enormous. And you'll read some story about it, 1 million trees planted in a day somewhere, 10 million somewhere else, and it's usually a minister or president standing, posing with a shovel. And there's so many, there's no long-term structure either to support the trees or measure what they're doing. And if you talk to any tree experts, they all say, well, actually, you've got to get a tree to the age of 15 or 20 before they pull in sort of significant amounts of carbon anyway. And then they've got to live for 70, 80, 90 years beyond that. And how many sort of structures, governance structures, do we have that run that long, where trees can be supported and looked after and measured? So a lot of this is sort of slightly seat of the pants stuff, isn't it?
And just to say on that, I believe there was a great study which showed that in many cases, the various different CEOs and ministers who were talking about their million trees were often talking about the same million trees.
Yeah. but the challenge... more to say? Because I thought I was about to interrupt you. Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, that's the problem with long-term schemes versus short-time political cycles. Mm. There's incentive for politicians to do a dramatic thing now which attracts attention, not to conduct a 15 or 50-year evaluation to find out whether their policies had an effect.
Thank you. I wonder whether we could just move on briefly before we come to the audience to talk about communication of evidence. can good evidence be communicated badly, or is evidence evidence?
I mean, one example that I will always remember was 2021, when the COVID vaccines came onto the scene, late 2020, early 2021. And there's a former institution that's part of Cambridge University called the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication. And they were tasked with coming up with essentially the sort of press release, the communications, the graphic and everything that was going to be the official announcement of the evidence on vaccine effectiveness and safety and all of that. And they all squirreled away in a room for a week or so and came up with this chart, which, and I'm now going to do everyone's favourite thing of describing a graphic. but it showed, it was essentially for each age group, on one side it had the number of hospital ICU admissions that would be avoided from people taking the vaccine. And on the other side, it was the number of severe side effects that people in that age group would get. And that was such an important choice to show the side effects as well as the benefits for two reasons. So first of all, it just made clear that certainly for the vast majority of people, down until you got to people in their 20s, the benefits significantly outweighed the harm. So it just implicitly made the point that the vaccines were a good thing to take. But the fact that it showed the harms as well, and that the risk, the cost-benefit trade-off, got a lot more ambiguous as you got to young people, that meant that vaccine sceptics and those types of people, if they looked at this graphic, they wouldn't feel condescending. They wouldn't feel, oh, this is just someone saying, take the vaccine. This was someone saying, look, everyone should probably take the vaccine. Young people are a bit less sure. There was information there for everyone. And I think it speaks to this idea. There's the term that people now use is the ABI model for trust, which is ability, benevolence, and integrity. Those three things are key to whether someone's going to trust the information you present. So ability is just, you know, are you a serious official person who has good methods? That bit is usually already there when someone is presenting evidence. But then the benevolence, the integrity bit, really important. So I'll go integrity and then I'll come back to benevolence. Integrity is, again, are you someone who should be trusted? So that will be, are you talking about how you calculated this as well as just saying what you calculated? Have you shown your sources, that kind of thing? But the benevolence bit is then really interesting. This is basically, is anyone who sees your evidence, does anyone have reason to think that you're not on their side? It's not just about are you a good person, it's are you ostensibly good to everyone? And that matters because so many bits of science and evidence now, unfortunately, have become polarised. So whether that's vaccines, whether it's climate change, that you really need to be trying to make sure when you are presenting evidence about things like vaccines or climate change, presenting it in such a way that someone who is sort of ideologically opposed to your lot is not going to be primed to think of that when they see your evidence. So I just find that really powerful. And the way I think about it in the work I do at the FT is almost what's more important than me presenting a good, clear piece of information is that the number of people who can consume that or will feel happy to consume that information is as broad as possible. And so that comes to like the clarity of what you're communicating and not giving people a reason to think that you're against them, as it were.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you.
Do you want to go or shall I go?
I'll go okay. Briefly. I mean, I think that's so interesting because I'm reporting on trust in science at the moment, and there is a lot of research that supports that idea that if you are open about the uncertainties and the process of science, that is a better way of building trust around vaccines, for example. But what I wanted to say about communication of evidence is I think that even if you have all of those qualities, where scientists are losing is obviously online. I mean, you can have all of those things, but unfortunately, all of those qualities do not get the recommendation algorithm to put your post to the top. And so the people I talk to about trust in science, I mean, actually say, I mean, some people argue that it's not that scientists are losing trust, they're losing influence, because the algorithm is going to amplify the posts which evoke emotion and outrage, not the ones which present potentially benevolent, dry facts.
I'd like to pick up on the opposite of benevolent. I suppose it's malevolent, is it? I mean, that in the 1850s, an amazing woman scientist called Eunice Newton Foote experimented with gases in glass jars. In one experiment, she had a jar just with normal air in it, and she put it on the windowsill in direct sunlight and took its temperature at the beginning and then hour or so later. She had another jar which she filled with carbon dioxide. Windowsill, direct sun, measured the temperature before and after. The one with the CO2 was massively hotter and stayed hotter than the other one. And she wrote it up. Because she was a woman, the paper wasn't properly published. A man had to read her paper at a conference, but it wasn't taken seriously. So that was one massive obstacle right from the start. And she was one of the very first people to discover the heat-trapping property of CO2. So that was a communication fail straight away. But to get to the malevolent point, if you fast forward a century or so, Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, gave a speech to the American Petroleum Institute in 1959. And he was a hawk, a real Cold War warrior. He was someone which I presume the petroleum engineers had hired to do a stirring pro-oil speech. He actually gave the opposite. He said, you know, if we keep burning fossil fuels, we'll be releasing this CO2 into the atmosphere, and New York might go underwater because the ice sheets will melt. Now, obviously, the oil industry didn't take that warning seriously from Teller and embarked, using the big tobacco playbook, on decades of really hostile action to undermine any communication of the science of climate change, and indeed the science itself, with personal attacks, among other techniques. And that went on and on and on, even though at the same time, during the 70s, 80s and 90s, the big oil companies were funding and commissioning their own scientists to study the effects of burning fossil fuels. And those guys came up with unpublished, obviously, suppressed work that tracked, predicted with great accuracy what would happen. That if we keep burning fossil fuels by about 2020, we'll have 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere and we'll be about a degree warmer. That's pretty well what happened. So I think any discussion of communication has to be done in the context of a hostile environment. You know, everything said, whether it's COVID or any kind of medication or climate, is immediately entering a free fire zone. And we see this all the time, and it's getting worse. And one reason it's getting worse is because big oil can see that it's up against a really challenging context itself. Namely, if you look at what's happening with China and the incredible take-up of electric vehicles and the explosion of solar and wind power and the rise of batteries and all the rest of it, China's importing less oil. That's a catastrophe for the big oil companies. And you're seeing all over the world, different emerging economies, probably exacerbated by the Strait of Hormuz crisis, really investing in green tech. So the efforts of the incumbent industries will become ever more violent and aggressive. And you're seeing this all the time in certain newspapers and internet sites and all the rest of it amplify this. So I think communication has never been more critical. And just a sort of final point about this. For me, it's about finding the language that resonates with everybody. Mm. Let's reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in order to hit our net zero targets to save the planet is an absolute lead balloon with most people. But if you say, you know, your house, it might become uninsurable quite soon against flooding or wildfire. Or if you say, you know, your daughter's asthma, it's made worse by traffic fumes from SUVs. You get a very, very different reaction. And I think those of us who believe in evidence, however we define it, and believe that we are heading for trouble, but don't need to. Getting the communications right, but knowing we're in this hostile landscape is absolutely key.
Thank you. I've got loads more questions, but I'm not going to hog any more of the time. So we'll take questions in the room, but also Louise is monitoring on them online. Please wait for the microphone to come to you. If you raise your hand, I can see there's somebody over there. We'll maybe take a group of questions. So there's one here as well. So yeah,
remember the questions.
You mentioned evidence was information. So if it is information, there is the creator of that information, and also there's the communicator of that information. My question is, and we talked about, you mentioned good information, and Mr. Shipman gave examples, and you all gave
examples. Please, I'm David here. I'm David.
Okay,
yeah.
David.
Thank you.
So my question is about what constitutes good evidence, whose evidence is good, and is evidence or the creators of that evidence, sometimes is there an inherent bias? So this isn't my thoughts, but Anita Naidu, a communicator, said the most powerful thing colonialism produced is authority. And that authority produces expertise and prescribes solutions and essentially defines reality. So I would really like to hear your thoughts about this.
Thank you.
Especially the lived experience of the global majority and also their evidence. Like, we don't know, there might be research that we don't know about because it's not communicated, it's not, you know, we don't know about it because it belongs to the global majority and not the Western world.
Thank you. We'll take another couple of questions. There's two here and then we'll move to the panel. Thank you.
A question I have is regarding attempts to counter misinformation. There's a very clear narrative that someone's misinformed, you present factually correct information, they update their beliefs in accordance to that and end up being now correct. It seems a very naive account, especially when you consider psychological sciences, where you can see what's referred to commonly as continued inference. You have a person having an assumption corrected, and rather than having their worldview changed accordingly, that individual assumption they had, they will now deny, but seemingly everything they've built on top of that assumption, all their activities, their worldview, none of that shifts at all. So it seems quite a challenge to you, the idea that evidence even has this much weight to counter misinformation. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And behind you.
Hi, I'm a researcher at the University of Glasgow, and I do a lot of the social policy research that is really difficult to evidence. And one of the things that is always an issue in my work is getting access to routinely collected data, and that is the sort of thing like universal credit information, NHS information, privately linked, de-anonymized data that we can do evaluations of things like social policies, Scottish Child Payment, I'm based in Glasgow, and I was wondering if there's anything that you think researchers could be doing to help kind of communicate the importance of routinely collected data for like natural experiments and, yeah, for how important that is that the UK has such rich routinely collected data that I don't think we're really making the most of.
Thank you. John, should we start with you?
I'll take the misinformation one if that's all right, because I think it's a great question. And yeah, I certainly agree that the assumption that just, just give people evidence, just educate them out of their ignorance, I think that has been proved fairly conclusively wrong. So I agree with you on that. One thing I would say is that the evidence of where that can at least work is if the corrective information is happening in the same time and place, at least, as the misinformation. So the social media platform X, obviously, has justifiably quite a bad reputation these days. But one thing I think that platform did very well, and it actually predates Elon Musk taking over, was community notes. So this idea of corrections which are made directly on the piece of misinformation at the same time as misinformation, that has actually been proven to do fairly well. Similarly, I'm kind of optimistic about the role of AI in this space. So another thing you see now on quite a few social platforms is people essentially asking AI to fact check what someone has said on social media. And there's, again, fairly good evidence that people even say, like, this happened in, I'm going to use another American example because that's often where the extreme examples of misinformation come from, but in the aftermath a few months ago of the shooting of American citizens by Immigration Customs Enforcement, there were examples of Republican and sort of quite far-right Americans on social media asking the AI bot Grok if it was true. You know, surely this is fake news that that our government and our security forces would have shot a US citizen. And Grok turned around and said, no, it's true. And there was at least seemed as if these people were then taking that on board. So I'm optimistic that we're getting better solutions now for correcting stuff in real time. I do agree with you, though, as well. That still leaves the question of, okay, even if you correct someone on that one point, has that changed their worldview? Or is it just they've just said, okay, well, fine, I'll ignore that, but the rest. But I'd be optimistic that if someone gets corrected on something enough, that maybe it starts to change their whole approach. But I do agree with you fundamentally that then we have nowhere near enough evidence on what actually works to counter misinformation.
Yeah, agree. I'll speak to the bias one. I mean, you know, is there bias around evidence? Yes, enormously, absolutely, about who produces this. And I think you were speaking a bit to, is there a bias towards evidence which, for example, is from high-income countries or, you know, has that particular worldview to it? Absolutely. I mean, I definitely observed that around this kind of evidence movement that I was reporting on, that, you know, it kind of grew up in the global north and has been very excluding of nations and people in the global south. And not only that, but that then influences, I mean, what problems we even studied, right? Where are we even collecting the evidence? So I think that's a fantastic point. There is absolute, and this comes back to the point of, like, what is evidence? I mean, indigenous knowledge about the natural world is important information which needs to be collected and acknowledged and used, for example, when evidence is synthesized. So I completely agree with that. I mean, I would say that I'm seeing a lot of fields are at least starting to wake up to that problem. And so, for example, I mean, there's an interesting initiative which is emerging at the moment called the Evidence Synthesis Infrastructure Collaborative, which is trying to build. It's got an amazing vision of basically saying, wouldn't it be amazing if anyone in the world could push a button and produce an accurate, authoritative evidence synthesis on their question, whether it be a citizen or a policymaker. Now, that's another thing, AI-fueled, by the way. That's something AI ought to be able to help with. And there's a real movement within that to centre that whole movement within the global south. So I think, you know, hopefully things are edging towards a corrective, yeah.
There's that old saying that a falsehood can get halfway around the world before truth has got its boots on. And we see this time and again. The LA fires in January last year, Trump starts tweeting about the Democrats and water policy and it's all their fault, which just took no account of the reality. And then it took actually days, in fact weeks, for a kind of truer picture to emerge of why that fire was so severe. It is a problem. I hadn't really thought that AI might actually be an asset in this. So thanks for sort of saying that. But actually I have observed, I'm a passive observer of X now. I can't stand contributing to it because I get beaten up too often. But actually I've noticed that Grok will now and again actually be quite quick, or very quick and right, about something that's climate related. So maybe that's something to be hopeful about. In terms of the sort of global north-south bias, I mean, hands in the air, my book has mainly got British examples, mainly because I was so angry at the state of the lack of readiness in this country for what's happening now in terms of these new extremes, let alone what's to come. So I kind of don't make an apology for that, although I'm extremely interested in seeing what examples there are from around the world. And one that really strikes me, and it really, it's actually quite shocking to a lot of people. I mentioned China and the rise of its electro-state thinking to move away from being dependent on imported oil. I think there's an arrogance in the global north, particularly among the big car makers and many governments, about what's happening in China. Surely they just assemble iPhones for us. No. They've actually got an incredibly innovative and vast and very active set of industries which are now dominating in these new technologies. And that's enabled, for example, Pakistan which has been dependent for too long on a hopelessly inadequate national grid. People are desperate for power. A few years ago, somebody spotted that there are these cheap Chinese solar panels, and they've been flying off the shelves in Pakistan. People have just been buying them. Farmers buy them. They don't even bother to buy the frames. The panels go on. They just lay them flat in the fields and then just plug them into their pumps or whatever they need the power for. So, I mean, I think there's a lot that the North has to learn from the South, a number of countries like Pakistan going down that road, and indeed from China. And I'd now forgotten what the third one was, even though I've written it down.
It was about the fact that we've got lots of data in this country that
might not be useful. I was going to say, one thing that I completely agree, I benefit usually in my job from the amount of high-quality data we have on like socioeconomic outcomes and that kind of thing. That means I can go and ask original questions of that data and have them answered. But at the same time, I think we could always do even better on that. And I think one thing that's been a struggle over the last couple of decades now in the UK is trying to persuade the public that we should be recording and digitising more data. So there was the care.data example with the NHS a while back. There's new conversations around digitising NHS records so that your GP, the hospital, everyone has all of that joined up together. It still always amazes me how many bits of paper are flying around doctors' offices. But it's also, this is really important because so Denmark and some of the other Nordic Scandinavian countries have what we call population registers, where every single person in the country has very detailed data, many data points about this person, about not just their demographics, but their job and everything. And that means a lot of things that we now know to be true about the world, we only know because Denmark has a population register. So things like the fact that when a woman has a child, her earnings take a significant dip relative to a male, to the father's earnings. And that lasts essentially for 20 years. That's never caught up. We only know that because Denmark has that data on everyone. And I think I would love us to be able to have a bigger conversation as a society about when we ask you to fill in these forms and can we hold that information on a computer, enormous social good can be achieved from that. And often healthcare, like the UK Biobank, has been a key source for a lot of medical innovations. So there are huge benefits that you may not be able to think of as an individual right now, but that other generations, countries, societies will get. So absolutely right, the UK does well on this, but we could always do better.
And I think you can get the public interested. I'm just thinking of national surveys that are purely voluntary, of people counting different species of birds in their garden. You know, they get an incredible response. So I think if it's framed the right way, people will be enthusiastic.
And trust, which you were always talking about before, is crucial here. We need to take at least one question from online, but if you can make it really short.
A very quick online question. You've already touched on misinformation. G. Thomas, member of the public, mentions the 10th anniversary of the disaster of Brexit and asks why we ignore evidence. Is some evidence just too difficult to understand?
I just say it goes to the communication point. I mean, lies were peddled during the Brexit campaign. There were attempts to correct them. The corrections weren't believed. There was a sort of tsunami of whipped up support for the idea of breaking free from Europe. And whatever people said in response, it didn't count.
It wasn't an evidence battle. I mean, that was a political battle. And part of the whole populist movement is the realisation that politicians can gain more influence and votes by rejecting evidence and by denying kind of, you know, evidence-based, you know, interventions, you know, such as vaccines. So I think that really is... evidence was never going to win that battle.
I think the other issue there was that sometimes the evidence being presented from the Remain side was not the thing that mattered to the Leave side. So when it was talking about GDP impact, for example, the response was, who's GDP? Now, I personally take issue with that because I think that actually a lot of people on the Leave side and people who feel left behind have still benefited from economic growth. But, yeah, there was this sense of two sides talking past one another, and I think that applies more broadly, that evidence can be rock solid, but if it doesn't speak to someone's the thing that someone's concerned about, then you need to come up with different evidence.
Thank you. I think you had one final. Maybe we could have one final question in the room. If gentleman there, If you can make it super short, because we're right up against our deadline.
I'm Oliver, alumnus in philosophy of science at LSE. My question is about the closely associated topic about values in science and values and evidence. And you know, there's a argument VFI, value-free ideal, which there are arguments against it, the most prominent inductivist argument, which talks about the non-epistemic consequences, non-epistemic, political, moral, social...
Get your question.
Yeah, and political, social consequences of error. And I wanted to know how much scientists consciously think about how much evidence they need to, what threshold of statistical significance that they can request before accepting or rejecting the hypothesis.
So maybe on the climate debate about, maybe there's something there about, you mentioned RCPA 8.5, like how much evidence do the people in the climate space need to think they have before they make a pronouncement?
Well, that's a subject of debate, actually, within the climate world. I mean, you know, and I always think, you know, perfection is the enemy of the good. I think, you know, for going way back to Eunice Newton Foote and her jars, you know, we've accumulated over a century and a half enough evidence to know that there's a problem created if we keep burdening the atmosphere with a heat-trapping gas. But, I mean, when you get into, for example, you know, how should companies or individual organizations respond to this and what should they do? The great cry is we need data. We need to know much more accurately in a fine-grained way what the effect of our actions might be or the effect of not taking action. And that's when you get into another whole debate.
On that note, I think we're at the end of our time slot here. I mean, we could have carried on for another hour really easily. So as mentioned previously, there are books outside to buy from Helen and David if you wish to, and they'll happily sign them. There are more events in the festival this afternoon, so do stick around and go along to some of the other exciting talks. But I hope we can close by you joining me in thanking our fantastic panel for a really interesting hour.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.